It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
We have an Affordable Housing Trust Fund. The ordinance itself was passed in 2008, which is 3 years ago. No money has ever gone into the fund. No housing units have been created. Nothing has been done since the passing of the ordinance in 2008.
The Reverend Micah Jackson from 7th Street Memorial Baptist Church and a member of the Steering Committee of Richmonders Involved to Strengthen Our Communities, or RISC, discusses the latest efforts to provide money to the city's unfunded Affordable Housing Trust Fund at the Nehemiah Action on Thursday, April 14, at Good Shepherd Baptist Church. And during this week's News You Can Use, we highlight some of the benefits of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, which celebrated its one-year anniversary last month. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 121, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM Richmond Independent Radio and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. Last month marked the first anniversary of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. Although only 1 year old, the health care law is already helping Virginia's small businesses, young people, seniors, the uninsured, and working families. Thousands of Virginians are already seeing the benefits of the Affordable Care Act. Among the benefits, 102,000 small businesses will receive tax credits to help them afford coverage. 123,000 children with pre-existing conditions can now obtain coverage. 54,000 young adults are now able to stay on their parents' insurance plans until they are 26 years old. 1.2 million Medicare beneficiaries now have access to free preventative health services. And 74,000 Medicare beneficiaries received a rebate to cover prescription drug costs. However, the new law remains under attack in both legislative and judicial forums, with 25 cases having been filed to challenge the law. Of these, the court overturned the law or part of the law in 2 cases, ruled the law constitutional in 6 cases, dismissed 5 cases, with 12 cases remaining pending. In other news, last month, in a 6-2 decision, the U.S. Supreme Court relied upon the basic objectives of the Fair Labor Standards Act and held that a claim for a wrongful discharge in retaliation for a complaint could include an oral complaint as well as a written complaint. The lawsuit alleged that Kevin Kasten complained to his employer about the location of the time clock, which prevented workers from receiving credit for the time they spent putting on and taking off their work clothes, and he was discharged in retaliation for complaining about the location of the time clocks. The lower court held that retaliation could not be based upon an oral complaint. Reversing, the Supreme Court noted that limiting complaints to written complaints would undermine the Act's basic objectives and observed that Congress did not want to limit the effectiveness of enforcement by discouraging workers who found it difficult to reduce their complaints to writing, particularly illiterate, less educated, or overworked workers. The court pointed out that rejecting oral complaints would limit the government's ability to use hotlines, interviews, and other oral methods of receiving complaints. With this week's news you can use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
This week's case that changed the Commonwealth is Elder versus Elder. In September 1921, J.B. Elder called his wife vile names, accused her of adultery, threatened to cut her throat and shoot her. He ordered her to leave the marital home, and wisely, she did. 2 months later, the wife offered in a letter to return to the marital home upon a promise of good treatment. In a reply letter, J.B. Elder agreed and offered to meet with his wife to work things out. However, she wrote back and said she had changed her mind, as she was afraid his treatment would be worse than ever. She filed for divorce, which was denied because her letter had condoned or forgiven her husband's conduct. The Supreme Court of Virginia reversed and granted the divorce, saying condonation requires an actual restoration of marital rights. This has been the law ever since. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault, and Elder versus Elder is this week's case that changed the Commonwealth.
It's time for this week's question and answer session. We're here at the studio with this week's questioner. Please tell us your name and where you're from.
My name is Ken. I'm from Richmond, Virginia.
Welcome to the show, Ken. What question do we have this week?
Child support. What sense does it make to put the people in jail and take their license and stop them from being able to pay their bills? They can't pay their bills if they're locked up, but they don't have a license to get around to get to a job. It just doesn't make sense.
Well, I would agree with you, Ken. That doesn't make sense if that were the very first thing that the Juvenile and Domestic Relations Court or the Division of Child Support Enforcement did. But it really isn't the first thing that they do. One of the things people need to understand is that once child support has been ordered and is unpaid for a period of 30 days, it becomes a judgment by operation of law, and it cannot be changed retroactively. That is, past due child support cannot be changed. It also can't be discharged in bankruptcy. The only thing that can be done to get rid of it is to pay it. And if people are unable to pay it, then they need to do two things. One is they need to pay at least something toward it, even if it's just a few dollars a month, just to show they haven't forgotten about the obligation. And secondly, they need to go to either the court or the agency that ordered the support and file something in writing to lower the support. If the support is lowered, then the lowered support can take effect with the month in which the request was made, even if it takes several months for the request to be acted upon. But if you sit back and do nothing and ignore the obligation, that's when you could end up losing your driver's license, ending up in jail or more. And what the court or the agency will do is they will send you papers, usually a motion for show cause summons, to come into the court or the agency to explain why you haven't paid, why you haven't moved for a reduction, why you've essentially ignored the obligation. And if you don't have a good explanation, or if they do it over and over and over, then more or less as a last resort, as a desperation move, the court will put people in jail, sometimes up to 12 months, and the court or the agency will suspend someone's driver's license. It should be a last resort. It's not always a last resort, but it should be a last resort. It's a way to essentially get somebody's attention. And you would be surprised how often money materializes to pay child support after somebody is jailed. But having said all of that, I would agree with the basic premise of your question that it really doesn't make any sense to put somebody in jail if they haven't paid child support. Obviously, they can't work and earn money in jail and pay child support. It doesn't make any sense to take away the driver's license, again, for the same reason. And here's the irony. When you're put in jail, the child support obligation continues to rack up. You continue to owe that child support for each of those months when you're in jail, and you're clearly not able to go out and earn money and pay it. Nevertheless, that's what the law is. Once ordered and unpaid, it becomes a judgment by operation of law unless a court changes it. Is that helpful?
Yeah, that's very helpful, because I didn't know these things, and it makes a lot of sense now.
Okay, well, very good. Thanks for being on the show. We're here at the 7th Street Memorial Baptist Church, and we are speaking with the Reverend Micah Jackson, who is on the steering committee of Richmonders Involved to Strengthen Our Communities, or RISC. And we are going to be talking this afternoon about RISC and about the upcoming Nehemiah Action, which is on Thursday, April the 14th at 6:15 p.m. at Good Shepherd Baptist Church on Church Hill. Welcome to the show, Reverend Micah.
Thank you.
Would you tell us, first of all, what is RISC, Richmonders Involved to Strengthen Our Communities?
RISC is a grassroots social justice organization which was formed by area congregations to be able to fight for those who are voiceless, to be able to help them afford those amenities and even benefits that the average citizen enjoys, but they are not able to afford. So we are a grassroots organization that starts from the ground up, and we work toward building our power so that we can speak for those who have no voice in the community.
And I gather this is an organization that is very church and faith-based, centered. Roughly how many congregations are involved in RISC right now?
Right now we have roughly about 13 congregations that form our organization of various political, social, and even faith affiliations that come together to fight for these causes.
And I gather that in the past, RISC has tackled issues and been quite successful. Could you share a few of those with us?
Well, one that jumps right off at the top of my head was the realization in 2007 of the lack of primary care access to those who are in our community who are on the lower rung of the economic scale. We found out that roughly 70,000 people were going without access to primary health care. And RISC jumped on board and started speaking up for those persons. And we have to date roughly assisted in attaining access for at least 18,000 additional persons through the VCU MCV coordinated health program.
That is quite an accomplishment.
Yeah.
Well, I gather that this year, 2010-2011, RISC chose a different issue, and it turned out to be housing and homelessness. Could you give us a bit of the history of that?
Well, we started in the fall of 2010 in what we affectionately refer to as house meetings. And from those house meetings, we finally came together, a small group of us came together, about 200 or so of us, and we met and voted on what was the most popular, passionate cause for our organization to date, and that allowed the cause for homelessness and housing to rise to the top.
And this may seem like an obvious question, but what is the problem here with housing and homelessness in Richmond?
We have too many people paying an exorbitant amount of their income for their housing. So we have over a third of our population in the metropolitan Richmond area who pay over a third of their salary for their housing, whether it be mortgage or rent. The problem with that is when you start to pay that much, now you have to make a decision between housing and eating or housing and health care, so forth and so on. And it makes for a very difficult living situation. And the higher your percentage of your income goes toward housing, the more you're at risk for being homeless. So we have these persons who we say live from paycheck to paycheck. You miss one paycheck and you've missed pretty much a mortgage payment or a rental payment, and you risk at that point becoming homeless.
So how do we create more affordable housing or create conditions that will lead to more affordable housing.
Well, one of the things that we discovered was what is known as an Affordable Housing Trust Fund. And that trust fund allows for the supplementing of persons as they go into purchasing a home, or as well as even subsidizing some kind of project that allows them to rent in a home. The Affordable Housing Trust Fund is something that is set up by the city. And it's not peculiar for Richmond. It is not unique to Richmond. It is actually a national effort, we've discovered. And many cities have successfully implemented this trust fund. And it has benefited many parties and many persons in the process.
So how many affordable housing trust funds are there around the country? And can you give us some examples of affordable housing trust funds in other cities that have had some success?
There are hundreds of them across the country. We have been made intimately aware of a few examples of successful trust funds. One was in Columbus, Ohio. Columbus, Ohio, seeded $5 million into a trust fund, and they were able to create 827 units of new housing for that locality. Another wonderful example and gleaming example that I love is Lexington, Kentucky. In Lexington, they were able to not only create 450 units of housing, but they were also able to create 300 new jobs, and they were able to add $40 million annually to the city economy. So that is one of the gleaming examples for me, because everyone benefits when it's done right, and that's really what we want to see in the city of Richmond.
And I gather from RISC's research in investigation into this, we learned that the city of Richmond has an affordable housing trust fund. Tell us the history of that.
We have an affordable housing trust fund. The ordinance itself was passed in 2008, which is 3 years ago. And this affordable housing trust fund was originally actually funded $200,000. Now, what happened to those funds, we are not quite sure of. But the basic necessities for this fund to be operational have not yet been done. So it was created in 2008. As of 2009, we had six of the 11 slots for the functioning oversight board. And that board never met. One member possibly has died as of right now, as per our research. And we contacted one of the members of the oversight committee, and they even forgot they were a part of it. So this has created, some fire under us, because we see this as a viable venue to help improve the vitality of our housing crisis in the city. Yet nothing has been done to do so using this vehicle.
So let me see if I understand this. This trust fund was created and an oversight board to be appointed 3 years ago. Only six out of 11 members appointed. The board's never met, and other than a small $200,000 that can't be accounted for, no money's ever gone into the fund.
No money has ever gone into the fund. No housing units have been created. Nothing has been done since the passing of the ordinance in 2008.
And what does RISC propose to do?
RISC proposes to, at least initially, get that oversight board completely appointed so that it can be a functional board. But then we also are looking for, a reasonable expectation is that they would fund this trust fund with seed into it enough money that will cause this to be able to make a significant dent in this crisis of affordable housing in our metropolitan area. That's the two major things we're pushing for right now.
Now, we mentioned earlier in the interview the Nehemiah Action that's coming up on Thursday, April the 14th at 6:15 p.m. What is the Nehemiah Action? First of all, why do we call it Nehemiah Action?
It's called Nehemiah Action after the Old Testament character Nehemiah, who returned to rebuild the walls of the city, to really restore the city to its, I almost want to say its former glory. And Nehemiah Action then is that venue or that assembly that we have that will cause us to come together along with city officials in the effort to restore our city, and I'll use this term loosely, to its former glory, that those who have not will have, that all of us will benefit from, if you will, and I use it loosely, the have-nots will benefit from those have-nots becoming haves. Because when those who do not have affordable housing, when they don't, these persons are able to get into houses they can afford, then they will benefit the larger community set. So what we're trying to do is gather all of those persons at Nehemiah Action. And Nehemiah Action is our assembly where we actually look for action and commitment. Action on the part of the city and commitments to follow through with the actions that have been asked for.
And by the city, I mean, who specifically are we asking to do what by when?
We are looking for city council primarily, because they are the ones that passed the ordinance originally. We're looking for city council to fully appoint this board, whether they have to start from scratch or whether they just need to fill the vacancies. We want them to do this by June 10th so that this board can meet and begin to discuss a stream of revenue that will continually feed into this fund to access affordable housing to those who do not have it. That's basically what we're looking for right now, for this, for city council to do this. And then after that, we're looking for the city of Richmond proper, the mayor's office, to do its part with regard to the ordinance, which is to set up those policies whereby we will have some governance as to how these funds will be dispersed and distributed and how they will be able to benefit those who are less than fortunate in our community.
And by the less than fortunate in our community, are we talking about the poor in general? Are we talking about the neediest of the needy? Who exactly are we talking about here?
We're focusing our attention on the neediest of the needy, the lower 30 percentile of our average median income, that at least a good portion of those funds would benefit that group, that working class group, that group that is really struggling to make it day to day.
And so who is going to be coming to the Nehemiah Action on April the 14th?
On April the 14th, in addition to the 13 congregations comprised of over anywhere from 1,000 to 1,500 people in the audience, we're going to have right now committed all 9 council persons, including our president and vice president of the council. And we're looking forward to seeing them and hearing affirmations from them to be a part of this experience.
And tell us again when and where this takes place.
Nehemiah Action Assembly will take place on April the 14th, roughly at 6:15. It starts our registration p.m. And we will be at the Good Shepherd Baptist Church, which is located 28th and R Streets in Churchill in East Richmond.
And I guess I gather that this is open to any member of the public who is interested in attending.
It's open to anyone who's interested in this cause, anyone who's interested to see the outcome.
Thank you very much. We have been speaking with the Reverend Micah Jackson. He is the pastor of the 7th Street Memorial Baptist Church and also a member of the steering committee of Richmonders Involved to Strengthen Our Communities, also known as RISC. Thank you very much, Reverend, for being on the show.
Thank you.
This week's Strange But True Law is from Title 8.1A through 8.11, which is the Commercial Code. We've all gotten those warranty registration cards we sometimes send in and sometimes don't when we buy a new product with a warranty. But now, under Code of Virginia 8.2-317.1, not returning that card could take away your warranty. Under this 2010 law, if a seller conspicuously discloses in advertising and marketing material that returning the warranty registration card is required for warranty coverage and you fail to do so, you lose your warranty coverage. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King, and that's this week's Strange But True Law.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio show ever broadcast is now available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral for, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. Every adult needs two vital advance directives, a medical power of attorney and a living will. Join us next Wednesday at 12:30 p.m. when private attorney Nathan Kottkamp at McGuire Woods discusses the upcoming National Healthcare Decisions Day on Saturday, April 16, and explains how easy and important it is to just do it and sign these advance directives. That's law for the rest of us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright.